I don't think that if we think simply about sex in this central way, that it can explain the kinds of problems that women feminists have had in trying to deal with issues of sexuality, and men supporters of feminism have tried to also in terms of coming to grips with some of the issues. I want to talk this afternoon a little bit about sexuality and identity from a woman's point of view, and insofar as women are both unique and variations on a theme, I think that some of these remarks can be generalized as well. First, I want to talk a little bit about conflicts in these terms, and then I want to suggest a few thoughts for what this might mean about sexual representation. Well, let me begin with a very bald statement and say that for women as a group, there is a fundamental contradiction between being a developed and open sexual being and being an accepted member of society. There's no simple way in which being a woman and being sexual can be continuous or unproblematic or a happy situation for us. There are a lot of feminist theories, some of which overlap, some of which compete, which have tried to explain why this is the case, and I won't be able to do them all justice this afternoon, but let me suggest a few things picked up from the body of work we have developed. First of all, keeping women's sexuality under masculine control has been a way of keeping a certain right of access to women's bodies for men. This establishes a right to women's labor and to women's children, and some people have argued that children are embodied women's labor, so we have that. It also establishes men's access to a certain kind of sexual pleasure. And here I want to make one parenthesis, which is that it sounds very good for men, but I think it's a very lousy situation for men. And if someone wants to ask me in the discussion why I think that's the case, I'll explain it. Today I'm going to talk more about how women experience it, because I'm interested in talking about women's representation of sexuality. Okay. In Judeo-Christian society, the central construct that this kind of a situation has produced has been the Madonna-whore axis, or the prude-slut axis, or the virgin-bad girl axis. Depending on where we're located historically, we can play with these things or be kept in line by them, I think is more to the point. What the I like Madonna-whore because of the following reason. I think it's the most accurate way of describing how the sexual function and the sexual woman have been separated from the maternal function and the maternal woman in such a way as to set maternality and eroticism against one another. And what that does then is it sets up an enormous conflict, because since most women are both maternal, either in the sense that they have children or they are social adults interested in the nurturance of society, we can extend it symbolically, and sexual, it sets up a conflict interior to our identities about ourselves. And this is manifested then in a set of conflictual and unstable set of feelings and ideas about sexuality and about, and sets up an inherent contradiction between a coherent, integrated identity and our feelings of sexuality more generally. Okay? So, a very unstable and conflictual sense of identity when sexuality is brought into the picture. Identity for women is not, in any simple sense, a kind of quiet place where sexuality can live, neither individually nor in the mass psychology of women today. And women are, as a result, with reason, ambivalent about sexuality and its representation. One of the most important consequences of this, in the sense of the way, through the power of omission, whether we talk about our invisibility as subjects in cultural representation, our lack of subjecthood, is that women will very rarely engage in any form of public sexual expression. And although I really enjoyed what we just saw, most of that stuff, I think, is still dealing with gender, if we can somehow separate that from eroticism. We're still looking at the identity of who we are as women and how that's constructed. Very few of those works are right out there in that arousal or intent to arouse or the ability to arouse. It's not erotic in that particular way. Artists, in the larger sense of that term, and prostitutes have had something in common, women artists, brave women artists, in that they are the only women who have been willing to break those rules about women being able to express eroticism in public. And another small parenthesis, I don't think it's an accident in the last 200 years that artists and sexual subcultures have often found themselves living together because of their interest in pursuing these kinds of things. Okay. What keeps women silent? Well, people began to talk about it this morning. I have here on my notes in capital letters, fear. How does the fear originate, and what are we afraid of? Well, it seems to me there are two, there are probably more, but there's at least two very important things we're afraid of and places where the fear comes from. The first is what I call the rapist axe murderer, the battering lover, the police force. That is, the violent sanctions of men in a system of gender hierarchy called patriarchy, sanctions taken against women who are openly sexual in their own terms. And even in patriarchal terms, that is to say, when prostitutes break out of the ghetto, they are battered. And even in the ghetto, I understand from Margot St. James that the rate of battery of prostitutes is four times higher than that of non-prostitutes. So first of all, women are afraid of the violence that comes down on them. We talk about the heat is on, bringing down the heat from the patriarchal forces in society when they break or transgress the rules. But there's another place that it comes from. These two are related. I'm going to talk about the relationship, but let's conceptualize it somewhat separately for the time being. And that is, women are afraid of the anger of other women. And I think we also began to talk about that this morning. We're afraid of the stigma, the ostracism, the disapproval of women who are, by the way, very rarely loath to express themselves on certain issues that are important to them. I think that women are vocal in their own way, sometimes not in a positive way. We're afraid of the anger and the disapproval of women on, quote, moral questions. And if I were to give the first sort of place of fear a name and call it patriarchal relations, then I would talk about the second aspect as maternal disapproval. Now, let me just say for the record that my mother believed in a very open sexuality. So I'm not trying to lay the blame on mom. What I'm trying to talk about is how mothers and our view of women, if you like, the way that we interiorize that view of women, has that maternal cast to it. And I'm going to talk about why it's mothers' jobs to keep women under wraps sexually. And then, okay, so, but we have that sort of the patriarchal and the maternal. We experience the first, the patriarchal, as a terror of physical violence from the outside, from men who are predatory and violent and afraid of their own sexuality and afraid of ours. And we have to understand that violence that comes towards us as serious business, and we have to protect ourselves from it. The second, I think, we more experience as a fear of the social sundering that comes from the inside, from women, from our mothers, and let's talk about who those women might be to the women in this room, the sisterhood, the feminist sisterhood, as well as the more conservative voices of women who might be willing to call feminist sluts. It's one thing if, Phyllis Schlafly accuses us all of being lesbians and sluts. It's another thing if Gloria Steinem does it, and it feels very different to us when we have that kind of accusation coming down. Okay. It is important for us as women to understand that women's attitudes towards sexuality are very important because they are part of what permits, in a sense, patriarchal violence to carry on over a long time. If women ostracize other women, and feminists understood this, at least some feminists in the first wave of feminism when they defended prostitutes, if women allow other women to be ostracized and to be cut off, this opens up a space for patriarchal violence, which then shuts down to a certain extent, at least, if women close ranks on that. So it's very important when we talk about where women stand and how we are vis-a-vis other women. Okay. And let me give you an example, too. Last week in Toronto, there was a conference called Challenging Our Images, where sex workers attended. And this is the first one in Canada in the 4 or 5 years that we've been talking about pornography and sex work, where sex workers came and they spoke in their own name. It was a profoundly positive experience because women were forced, in a sense, to listen to the experience and the words of sex workers and then broaden the idea of feminism and include those women. So that if we're going to talk about we anymore, when we talk in feminist language, we have to include all women in that and not exclude others. More on that in a moment. Because of the danger that I talked about, I just want to underline before I say anything else that women's attitudes are never a simple thing because of these different sources of disapproval. And they're never solely determined by women. In other words, what women can do and what they can't do at any given point in time is demarcated to a certain extent by the fact that we are the gender with less political power than men. So, you know, what we have to do is slowly, over time, but boldly seek more and more to redefine the social terrain in our own terms. But there is that kind of ambivalence because of our relative powerlessness. Okay, for mothers, then, facing a world in which they have to send their daughters out, the issue is often a conflictual one, too. On the one hand, you want to maximize your daughter's ability to experience her being to the full, and that includes a full sexual experience. On the other hand, you want to protect her from the rules of patriarchy and how that violence goes, and so you have to teach her to take care of herself. And part of that teaching comes down through the form of taboos and prohibitions, which are then internalized as don'ts, a lot of don'ts, and perhaps even sexual prudery, as we call it. All right, so again, for women, the contradiction is between being free of fear about our sexual dimensions and still maintaining physical integrity and social respect. It's the contradiction between being sexual and having physical safety and social safety. The contradiction keeps the Madonna Virgin thing alive amongst our very own selves, not just from the outside. It also leads to the ghettoization of sexuality as a dangerous terrain which we have to put off to the side and not have as part of our own life. It leads to that socially. We have the ghettoization of sex work, of prostitution, and it leads to the ghettoization of sex in terms of our own personalities and our interior landscapes. What does this do? Three things in particular that I think are important. First of all, it has a conservatizing effect on our behavior. The fear of social punishment or rejection keeps women's sexual encounters down in number and certainly, modest in scope, in a very, I think, powerful way. And to the women, I suggest that you think about your own life and all the times you've said no when what you really wanted to say, okay, let's boogie. But you didn't do it because you were afraid of the consequences. Okay. So it has the effect of keeping women and women's effect on people of all, so people from both enjoying their own bodies and friendships and keeping other people from enjoying theirs. We suffer and so do our daughters. Incidentally, big parentheses, the gap between the potential for this kind of human experience, sexual experience in the fullest sense, and the reality of it today is in fact, I think, quite staggering. And I don't know your name, but you spoke today about how there's never any space for sex, right? All you have, there's groceries, there's work, there's everything else you can think of, but there's hardly any space for sex, unless you're madly in love and willing to, you know, throw all caution to the winds, get fired, that's right, 2 weeks. 2 weeks, 2 months, whatever it is, but, right, okay, then it goes. Our bodies are instruments of labor. And Laura Kipnis talked about this very well last night, I think, in her tape. I didn't like other aspects of her tape, but I like that. And I think it's very important for us to understand that what happens to our bodies is that they become instruments of labor. And that there is a contradiction between being instruments of labor and being instruments of pleasure. For us, we have two kinds of labor. We have the labor to feed and clothe ourselves and take care of ourselves in the world, and the labor to feed and clothe and take care of children and men. And so it's double labor, and if labor and sexuality are often counterposed in this society, we suffer doubly. So into this aching physical and spiritual space of sort of deadened and aching body, that modern consumption has built, Sexuality and sexual activity are sort of brought snarling on a leash into the public arena and attached to all of these commodities, you know, so which then beckon us and promise us that they will give us sexual pleasure, sexual charge, you know, when our bodies are numb, caress us when our skins are sore, all of these kinds of things. And I think that's very, very important for us to understand the way that this happens. But I wrote this before I saw Laura's tape, so I'll skip the rest of that section because I think most of you saw it last night. You know what I'm talking about. All right, so get back to the main point. It conservatizes our behavior. It keeps us less sexual, less adventurous, less fulfilled for all of these reasons. The second thing it does is it has a disintegrating effect on our identity. And I don't think this is just a matter for us and our therapists. I think this has a very major impact on our ability to be social and political actors in society as a whole. Because we're always more tentative than men. We're always afraid that maybe we can't say it the way we really think it. We always are afraid we're going to get punished for you know, talking loud like I am now. I mean, everybody knows, you know, when a man is assertive, it's good because he's doing what has to be done, and when a woman is assertive, she's an aggressive, ball-busting bitch. So that kind of thing works, and it makes us really afraid to really be who we are and to really stand out there and say, yes, we really do, and okay. And related to these kinds of things, it puts pressure on us as women to disown that troublesome erotic part of ourselves, and through that disowning, to repudiate other women who are sexual in ways which we have disowned internal to ourselves, which is why, in addition to the fact that we feel bad that a lot of sex workers have a lot of violence in their lives, perhaps a danger of disease, whatever, we're also really afraid of them because of what they represent in terms of a repudiated, disowned, repressed part of our very own selves. At least that's what I think. Okay. Just another few words on consequences. The fears of the social consequences of being an open sexual being don't simply exist out there, as I've already argued at some length now. Women internalize those fears as they internalize a set of values which will guide our behavior, same as men. What we learn out there, we take into us, and there's a whole psychoanalytic literature that talks about how that is, and I won't talk about that. I just want to say a few words about desire. Our identities are fragmented because of the contradiction between desire and social acceptability and our inability to accept certain parts of ourselves because of the way they threaten our social acceptability. Well, what is desire anyway? This is the most tentative of all of my of all of my points here. First of all, I think desire is based on bodily pleasure. I mean, I'm not talking about meditation and spiritual desire and whatnot. I do some of that, but I'm talking now about, you know, that sexual desire. It has an enormous, and I really have to insist on this, it has an enormous infantile component. And if we're going to talk about sexual representation, and especially about the regulation of sexual representation, we have to understand what sexuality and what desire are all about. You can't go around just saying, oh, this is bad and this is good, unless you have some sense of what desire is constituted. We are sexual virtually from the time that we take shape. You know, studies show that little boys are born with erections, I was going to say. That's a Japanese joke, which my maid has told. Anyway, they're born with erections and little girls with lubricated vaginas. You know, what about the little boy who wants to have his bum patted all the time? Is he going to have a spanking fetish when he grows up? And if he does, so what? So we have to understand these kinds of connections. We can't just go about, you know, treating sexuality as if it were something we acquired at the age of 18 when we first got our job on the assembly line or went to university. It doesn't work that way. Okay. It's also an aggregate of sensations and images and feelings and memories. It's not a sort of a simple rational thing. You can have very contradictory things. You know, you can want to be adored because you look like some of the women we saw in these slides, sort of traditional pictures of female nudes. And I think the same woman can want to be adored with all of her hair on her legs and her arms and strong as an Amazon. I mean, one can have both of these images. They aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but they're different. And people have all of these different things going on in their sexualities. But whatever it is, it transgresses patriarchal and maternal taboos because it's such a kind of wild, labile thing that inevitably breaks the rules. And that's one of the things I think that we have to look at. I had some examples of different fantasies which would break different rules, but I think that my time is... Actually, I was so scared that they're not very hot. But and of course, they're not mine. Yeah. All right. Well, perhaps you might have a sort of boyish androgynous fantasy, either that you look like that, which, as you can see, I do not, or desire someone like that of indeterminate sex. Well, that transgresses some of the patriarchal taboos about what you're supposed to be if you're a woman and whom you're supposed to desire and what you're supposed to feel like. Or you can have a sort of French underwear exhibitionist kind of fetish, which is like you really like the frilly stuff and the Merry Widows and stuff like that. Well, that transgresses the sisterhoods. Positions, because you shouldn't look like that, because those are the trappings of bondage. And actually, at a rational level, they are the trappings of bondage. If anybody wants to know about what whalebone corsets did to women's bodies, they really are the trappings of gender bondage. But, okay, the gap between the reality and the fantasy is an interesting gap to explore, and it's there. But that's the sort of thing that, you know, very few feminists would ever admit to having because of the way that that transgresses the sort of maternal or the sisterhood things. And then, of course, you can always have that polymorphous, perverse relationship to water or wind or horses. Now, you know, water and the wind, polymorphous, perverse relationship, that breaks capitalist taboos because that is sort of eroticization of the whole body and, you know, not the reduction to the instrument of labor and all of that. And horses, let me see, what did I write down? Oh, yes. Too animal-like. Now, anybody who grew up on a farm, I spent the first 7 years of my life on a farm, has to have some erotic attachment to animals of some sort or another, because it's all part of sort of, you know, that chaotic childhood sexuality and watching everything grow and everything happen. So, you know, it means a very different thing to one person than it would to another. But the other question I would like to ask is, what's wrong with being animal-like? What's wrong with being really, really letting it go and being involved in the bodily, physical experience and not being constrained by all of those other things? So that breaks, you know, just about every taboo there is. All right. So what does all this mean for representational strategies? I'm really not sure. Okay. All right, I'm going to go through a few points which have to do with some of the way the debates have been had. And Sarah spelled out a number of the different issues that have happened or that have been taken up in these discussions, and some of these relate to those you'll see as they go along. The first thing is that I believe we have to have sexually explicit and erotic expressions of women's experience. This does not go without contestation. We must appropriate our own sexual voices, not abdicate the airwaves in the name of the fear of representation, which has been guided by a number of theoretical positions, whether a kind of distortion of Foucault or Andrea Dworkin. Last week at the very same conference that I mentioned, a feminist spoke about how all sexually explicit representations are are embedded in a patriarchal context, and therefore women can never speak in their own voice, and we should simply not make sexually explicit or sexual representations at all. This is not an uncommon position. She was not the first one who dreamt it up. There have been a number of, I think, fairly dedicated feminist art theoreticians who've talked about this over the last few years. And it's a kind of abstentionism and refusal, which I sympathize with at one level, which is, you know, fuck you, you're not going to get any pleasure out of my body, no matter how hard you try, because I'm not going to let you see it. I mean, that's a kind of stance that, you know, one can get into at a certain moment. But I don't think that it works, because it abdicates in a particular way, and it doesn't allow us to challenge the views of ourselves. We can't leave public space empty of our expression, because of course it just gets filled up with all the stuff we've just seen in the slideshows. Given how much sexuality is exploited commercially and through the masculine lens, we have to find a way to inject it. All right, point one. The second point is that I think it is important for cultural producers, for women who are identified as artists, to work with means of expression and in a vernacular or a vocabulary that will reach large numbers of people, that will address men as well as women, and that will reach children as well as adults. I'm therefore in favor of an engaged erotic art and a popular art. Now, this is a problem for a couple of reasons. First of all, I believe that everybody is, like the erotic snowflake, absolutely individual. So that to make to make material that reaches large numbers of people might, at least at surface level, appear to be in contradiction with the fact that everybody is their own person, and you have to make material that speaks to, you know, the few other snowflakes that have sort of pointy edges rather than curved edges, or whatever the case may be. But I think that that difficulty notwithstanding, it is important to reach out. And, well, let me tell you about a couple of films which use popular genre in a way that's very empowering. Has anybody ever seen two slasher films called Seduction or Eyes of a Stranger? You have, right, okay. Very few women go to see these things. But what these films are based on is the taking of the convention and turning it around. So that not only is the woman not killed at the end by the, you know, rapist axe murderer, who is a figure in popular culture, but the women blow the rapist axe murderer away right on the stage. Now, I have a friend who's a feminist of some 10 or 12 years standing, and who is a fairly prominent person in the film community. She told me that when she saw the film Seduction a few years ago, it actually changed her life. This was like a piece of trashy garbage, which, you know, some fairly conscientious director thought, oh, well, let's do something different with it. But it was not, you know, a piece of high art in any sense of the term. And yet it had an enormous impact on her. In fact, she said that it made it possible for her to live alone, which she had never been able to do before because of the fears that she had. It is possible to work in a vernacular and to turn it around. And I'm not, I don't have time to go into all the ways that that's possible, but that's one of the things that we can consider doing. We have had some pretty amazing theoretical explorations of identity and sexuality by feminist art critics. And again, Sarah talked, I think, eloquently about some of the ideas that have come through. And they have been enormously valuable in our ability to understand what images are made up of, what's in them, what we want to do with them. But that's no reason to restrict our work to a kind of theoretical discourse. Mary Kelly's work is fascinating as a piece of deconstruction. It won't work as a piece of reconstruction of eroticism that's going to reach other people beyond a very small circle of specialists. So specialists should, by all means, continue to interrogate ourselves, to interrogate images, to interrogate culture. But let's not leave off our representations at that level. Let's have wall art, let's have school art, let's have street art, and by all means, let us use that video, because that is what people are watching. And it might be interesting for you to know that many studies now, from Glamour magazine to a porn programmer in Film Quarterly to many others, are doing studies which show that video is bought, pornography is being bought 60% by women, video porn these days. Women are curious about sexuality. Women want to watch it. Some of those women may be buying it for their guys, but guys have rarely been shy about going and getting their porn. Mostly, I think it's because women are interested in sexuality. A lot of women are buying gay porn because in it, men are shown as vulnerable. In it, maybe women can identify as the assertive partner. There's a variety of reasons. But women are buying video porn. So if you want to reach women with messages about sexuality, that is a place, I think, for us to look at. Okay. All right. Three, erotica versus question mark. I don't know what we're going to call that stuff. Some feminists have said that the answer to the problem of representation lies in making erotica, and then proceeded to try to define it as different than pornography. I've tried it myself. I tried for about a year trying to figure out how you could do that. And I came up with a very sort of abstract theoretical thing, which I then threw into the garbage because I realized it would be useless in terms of anything that would be practical. I don't think it's possible to make those kinds of distinctions in real life, particularly not when, as Amber spoke about, women, like men, see different things in different images. They're not all the same. And so you can't create a term out here that is going to encompass everybody's experience if the experience of the image is not simply what is produced, but what is seen. We've got a problem there, and I think we should acknowledge that. But there is an issue in feminist work about sexuality, and I don't think we should skirt it, but what do we validate and what don't we? And I think it is worth speaking to one another about what we think is important and what might characterize feminist work. What won't characterize it, as far as I'm concerned, is a prescriptive set of new norms that say what women can or can't do in bed. What will characterize it overall, I think, is the opposite of what happens when women are coerced into sexuality. One of the things that a lot of sexist pornography does is to validate the negation of women's desire and will. I put those two words together. Okay? Now, depending on how you see it, you may see it differently because you identify differently with it. But I think the fact that so many feminists have made a critique of a lot of sexual imagery, and it is a continuous part of the sexist culture that we're in, is there. It negates women's desire and will. Feminist work will validate women's desire and will. That's the bottom line as far as I'm concerned. What that desire and will be will vary from person to person. But that is something that it must do. It must then validate women's instrumentality. And if women's instrumentality is to be passive, then it will validate that. But there has to be a way in which we validate women's desire and instrumentality. And that, I think, is what will distinguish what I would call a feminist erotica. Having said that, I want us to sunder the term feminist and erotica and leave them apart. Okay. Now, the issue of power. Sue Golding will doubtless talk about power.